Genesis 38, the 36th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 14, 2003, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis 38 today. Seems like every week I have to print out my notes in a bigger font. At some point, this is going to be banners up here that I am using. This week, I'm not real good at such things, but I think that this week and next week will be PG-13. There's some tricky stuff in here. This chapter is, there is much that has been written about this chapter. I read in one commentary, this is by Spicer, he said, "The narrative is a completely independent unity. It has no connection with the drama of Joseph, which it interrupts at the conclusion of Act 1. So there's a question as to whether it should be here at all. Why is it here? It doesn't fit. It must be a mistake. It must have just been stuck in here and doesn't belong. There are chronological difficulties. There are real serious questions as to whether the chronology as presented here could possibly be worked out. And by more sympathetic commentators, they too see problems. One of the commentaries that I have used by Leopold says, this chapter is entirely unsuited to homiletical use. So I almost gave up at the get-go and skip this chapter, but actually this chapter is very, very interesting, I think. And I think the problems can be overcome. It actually does fit in, and it does, I'm going to argue, does have something to teach us if we understand what the Bible is doing. But the first one, is it connected with Genesis, the rest of Genesis at all? Is it just stuck in here haphazardly, or does it really fit in? There are a couple of works that were very helpful to me. One is a book called The Art of Biblical Narrative by Robert Alter. And another one is The Story of Tamar and Judah by one of my favorites, Umberto Casuto. Both of them deal with this chapter in particular. And both of them point out the same thing, and that is there are strong linguistic and thematic ties between this chapter and the other chapters of Genesis. That it can't be purely accidental that this chapter is here. That the author who put this stuff together is encouraging us to make ties between this chapter and the other chapters. And in particular, the author is encouraging us to make a connection between Joseph and Judah. The events in this chapter deal with Judah, but they are happening at the same time that Joseph is being transported down to Egypt and is rising up to become the Pharaoh's right-hand man. And the chapter starts out with the phrase, at the same time. And it says that in the first verse that Judah left his brothers and went down. Well, that's what happened with Joseph. He left his brothers and he went down. So there's a similarity there that we're being encouraged to see. In the chapter before, it used the terms examine and recognize. When the brothers took Joseph's coat and killed a kid goat and spread the blood on the coat, then they presented it to the father and they said, examine and recognize. Those same words will be used in this chapter. when Judah's identity becomes established, in the same term, examine and recognize. We have a kid goat involved in both of the deceptions, both in the deception of the brothers and in this deception in this chapter. And we have sexual temptation happening here with respect to Judah, and in the next chapter we have it with respect to Joseph. So I think there are enough indications that there might be, that the author might really want us to see a connection between what's happening in this chapter with Judah and the larger story of Joseph, wanting us to compare the two lives, that it's at least worthy of consideration that this chapter actually fits in here. Now I want to go through the chapter, and then I will briefly look at the chronological issues, probably very briefly, and then raise the question as to whether it has any homiletical value. The first 11 verses of chapter 38. And it came about after that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. And he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Er. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Anan. And she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Chezeb that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's son, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Anan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." And Anan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I am afraid that he too might die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So in this chapter, Judah too is leaving his brothers. He's separating himself from his family, as has Joseph done. But in this case, he's doing it willingly. It's his choice to separate himself. And where does he go? He goes to another village, and he visits a friend, Hira. Hira is apparently a close friend, a longtime friend. As we will see, they have a friendship that endures over the span of this chapter, and this chapter spans about 22 years. So Judah is developing close ties with the surrounding culture, with the Canaanite culture. Furthermore, when he goes to visit his friend, he sees this woman, a woman who goes nameless throughout the chapter. It's a woman that he marries. All we know about her with respect to name is that she is the daughter of Shua. If you put that into Hebrew, that's Bathshua, which is an alternate form of Bathsheba, just interestingly. He sees this woman, and he decides to marry her. Now, the author doesn't spend a lot of time developing this scenario. It's just three verbs. He saw her, he took her, and he went into her. That's all we've got. This is not exactly the makings of a Christian romance novel. Brevity is what he's concentrating on here. But he marries this Canaanite woman. What we see happening here is Judah is becoming incorporated into Canaanite culture. He has chosen to ally himself with Canaanite culture. This is interesting because We know earlier Abraham was insistent that his son not marry a Canaanite. There has been resistance to the Abraham and his children becoming incorporated into Canaanite culture. But Canaanite culture has been out there and surrounding them all this time. We've seen it lure others. We saw it lure Lot. We saw it lure Esau. And now we're seeing it lure Judah. And the culture is out there. It's waiting to seduce anyone who is willing to be seduced. And along the lines of what Margaret was saying earlier, we're in the same situation where the culture is out there and it keeps beckoning to us. And it's a constant beckoning to us. And if we allow ourselves to be seduced, we will be seduced. It's ready to do that. Now, part of what we're seeing here then is a kind of breakdown in Jacob's family. The sons of Jacob are becoming increasingly intrigued by the Canaanite culture around them and influenced by it. And Jacob is having less and less control over his family and his sons. One of the commentaries I looked at says, one gets the distinct impression that ever since the Dinah incident, which was in 34, chapter 34, Jacob has less and less control over the behavior of his family. Jacob is an old man at this point, but it is clear that in his old age, his sons are striking out on their own. They're charting their own courses, and their courses tend to go in the direction of becoming a part of Canaanite culture. Now, Judah had three sons by this unnamed wife. The first one, Er. There is much debate about what these names mean. Clearly, they mean something. That's a pattern that we see in the Old Testament, is the names are not given at random. They all have a significance and is appropriate in some way or the other to the child. The problem is it doesn't tell us what these words mean, and that is difficult to recover. Er could mean watchful, but another possibility is it could mean childless. That'd be a strange thing to name your oldest son, but that's a possible meaning for the name. And Judah's the one who gave that name to his first child. After that, it's his wife that gives the names to the child. The second child is named Anan, which means strong one, or alternatively, it could mean trouble or sorrow. And the third one is named Shelah, which means drawn out. Okay, these sons aren't good news. It doesn't say much about Er. It doesn't say what he did, which is unusual, because the Old Testament pattern would not be to say so-and-so was wicked, but to say so-and-so did X, and allow the reader to make the connection. But in this particular case, Moses has chosen to just say Er was wicked in the eyes of the Lord, and God took his life. Before he took his life, however, Judah picked out a wife for Er. Now, Judah picked his own wife, but Judah is acting as an authority figure in his family to a greater extent than Jacob had done, and he selects a wife for Er, and that's Tamar. But Er was wicked, and God took his life. There's no indication of mourning associated with Er's death, which is interesting in contrast to what had happened at the end of last chapter. When Joseph disappeared, Jacob was distraught, was unconsolable. We have no indication of that here. Er having died then leaves Tamar, who at this time is probably a young girl, probably quite young, like 18 years old, 18 or 19 years old. And Judah says to his second son, Anan, that he must perform his duty to her according to the customs of the time. Okay, let me describe the custom that's being described here. Every society that has any kind of heart has to come up with some way of providing for those who are widows. Because in ancient culture, it was very difficult for a single woman, especially a single woman with a family, to survive. And so the ancient culture came up with a means by which someone who is widowed could survive. I should point out, it was unlikely that someone who's widowed would be able to remarry. There was a stigma against marrying someone who had already been married, someone who was not a virgin. So someone who is widowed, and especially widowed young, they're really stranded. There's really not much hope for them. And how are they going to be provided for? Ancient culture did this through a custom called leveret marriage. A leveret marriage is where, and it varies from time to time, and we'll see that what's described here is a little bit different from what is prescribed in the Mosaic Law, but there is such provision in the Mosaic Law as well. That if a brother dies and leaves a widow, then it is the obligation of one of the brothers to provide an heir through the widow, to provide a child through the widow. And apparently the thinking is twofold. One is, it was really important in ancient culture for everyone to have descendants that would carry on your name and your blood. That was extremely important, and we've seen that earlier in Genesis, extremely important to Abraham and to Isaac. So that is apparently one of the considerations. The other consideration is to have a child that would grow up and be obligated then to take care of the widow in her old age. There would be someone with a blood connection to her that would feel an obligation then to take care of her. So that's apparently the logic behind the leveret marriage. Now, in the Mosaic Law, the brother would actually take the widow to be his wife. That was the obligation. He would actually take her into the household. She would become a member of the household. She would be cared for by him. That does not appear to be the case in Canaanite culture, which apparently was more akin to Mesopotamian culture at this time, in which case it was only the obligation of the brother to provide children through the widow, and he was not required to take her in as her his wife. So Judah tells Anan to perform his social duty, the customary duty that's required of him. That is to say that he is to have children through Tamar so that she will have heirs and will have children that will take care of her. And I need to point out one other thing. When that child is born, that child takes the place socially of the deceased husband of the widow. That means if Tamar has a child by Anan, that child then takes the place of heir, which means in the inheritance scheme, he is the firstborn. He gets the inheritance of the firstborn. And that apparently is a consideration for Anan here. He's thinking, let's see, with Er dead, I'm the firstborn. If I provide a child through Tamar, then he becomes the firstborn and I get moved down. So that's apparently part of the thinking here. Anan doesn't refuse to do what Judah has asked him to do. Judah is asking him to do the accepted, the culturally accepted thing in this particular situation. Anon doesn't say no. He ostensibly is compliant. But when it comes right down to it, he does not do what he's been asked to do. He has sex with Tamar, but withdraws. And she does not conceive as a result of the sex that they have. God's response to this, God was not pleased. Anon is not fulfilling his responsibility, and God takes his life then as well. So the two oldest brothers, the two oldest children of Judah, both have been displeasing to God, and God has taken their lives. What should happen next? Shelah, the youngest of the three sons, he should now perform his duty with respect to Tamar and provide children. However, Judah's spooked at this point. He's looking at the situation and he says, let's see. My oldest son marries this woman and he dies. Then I have Anon go and perform his duty with respect to her and he dies. There seems to be a pattern here. And the constant is Tamar. Apparently his concern is if he gives Shelah to Tamar, that Shelah will die too, and he will be childless. He will be without an heir. So he says, well, you know what? Shelah's awfully young, and we'll talk about the chronology later, but he's probably about 16 at this point. He's awfully young. Let's wait until he comes of age, and then you can have, he can provide children for Tamar. So he says, Tamar, just be patient. He's too young. And he says, go live with your father. Now, as I understand it, this would be a violation of the custom. She has married into the family of Judah. It should be Judah's responsibility to provide for her. First of all, by providing his sons so they can have a child through her. But secondly, he should be providing for her needs. And he's pawning her off. He's saying, go back to your dad. Let him take care of you. So Judah's really setting aside his obligations to Tamar. But Judah's thinking, apparently, I'm not going to give Shelah to her ever because I don't want to run the risk of losing my last heir. So Tamar leaves and she goes to live with her father, and he apparently takes care of her. And she waits. She waits for the time when Judah will do what's required of him by culture, by custom. Next section, 12 through 19. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give to me that you may come in to me? He said, therefore, I will send you a kid from the flock. She said, moreover, will you give a pledge until you send for it? And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. It says considerable time had passed. If you work out the details of the chronology, we aren't talking about a long time in the period in numbers of years. But I think what it means is more than enough time for her to realize that Judah is not going to do what he's required to do. It's probably only a couple of years, but it's more than enough time for her to determine what's going on. At this time, Judah's wife has died. So the daughter of Shua, who he had married, is dead. There's no indication that there is real mourning that's going on here. There is just the culturally required period of mourning that he has fulfilled. And he has gone through that period of time, and now culturally he can put that behind him, and he is apparently more than eager to do that. He is going to the sheep shearing. Now, the sheep shearing is apparently a big deal. It's a big celebration that accompanies this time of the year when the harvest is in, the work of the year has been done. We've had a couple of students in Gutenberg that live on a cattle ranch in Montana, and in the spring, they always want to go back home because of branding time, which is a similar kind of thing. It's a time when everybody comes together, everybody in the whole surrounding area comes together, and they do their branding, and it's a big deal. It's a big celebration. This must have been a similar kind of thing. The sheep shearing is going to happen. Judah does not want to miss out on this. It's a big celebration, and he goes to Timnah, where his sheep shearers are doing the shearing. And apparently at these festivals, there's a lot of drinking, but there is also, apparently, it's quite common to perform a ritual in which the farmer or the shepherd will hire a temple prostitute and have sex with her as a way of securing good crops for the next year, a fertility ritual of some sort. So Judah is headed for this celebration. He's going with his friend. This is the friend that through whom he had first met his wife. Tamar finds out about this. We don't know how she found out about this. It is left mysterious by the author, but it's hard to not think back to the chapter before in which a mysterious kind of incident set in train the events that led to Joseph being sold into slavery to the Ishmaelite caravan. That he just happened, Joseph, when he was sent to see his brothers, just happened to run into a man who knew where his brothers had gone. Had he not found that information, he wouldn't have been able to locate his brothers and be taken by them and sold into slavery by them. Here is another situation of happenstance. She happens to find out that her father-in-law is going up to Timnah to the sheep shearing. This is a smart girl. As soon as she finds out this piece of information, she comes up with this plan. And this plan is interesting because it's an attempt to try to approximate what custom requires for her to get her needs met. And it requires a great deal of knowledge of Judah and what Judah is likely to do. What is his behavior like? And she apparently knows Judah well enough to guess what he will do at various junctures in this plan. Now, she has some experience of Judah's sons, and maybe she's drawing upon that, that the similarity between the sons and the father is significant. But she's also had at least a little bit of experience with Judah, and she's able to guess on the basis of what kind of person he is and what his values are, what he is likely to do. But given all of that, it still requires a certain amount of luck. It's not hard to imagine how this plan could have been frustrated, how it could have not worked out the way she wanted it to. And yet, it goes right along. It works out just as she had hoped. What does she do? She dresses as a prostitute. It is tricky here to know what kind of prostitute she is posing as. There were two kinds of prostitutes in Canaanite culture. One would just be a common prostitute, which would be what we're familiar with. The other kind of prostitute would be a temple prostitute. A temple prostitute is a prostitute that is used for religious purposes, like I was just talking about, a fertility rite in which having intercourse with this temple prostitute constitutes a religious ritual, which is an appeal to the gods to provide fertility for one's crops or one's herds. The problem is both terms are used in this passage. They're separate words for the two kinds of prostitutes. In the first instance, it refers to her as a common prostitute. It isn't until later in the section we'll read next that the term temple prostitute is used. So is she a common prostitute? Is she posing as a common prostitute that is only later referred to as a temple prostitute to kind of sugarcoat what has happened? Or are we to understand her as a temple prostitute throughout? I don't know the answer to that. In any case, she is posing as a prostitute of one kind or the other. She has covered herself with a veil, which, to the best of my ability to determine, is not necessarily part of prostitute garb. The prostitutes sometimes did wear veils and sometimes didn't, and women who are not prostitutes sometimes wore veils and sometimes did not. The reason she's wearing a veil is so that he can't tell who she is, not as part of prostitute garb. But apparently she has distinctive prostitute clothing on, and she has placed herself by the gate of Enaim, which apparently would have been a common place for a prostitute to position herself. In any case, on his way to Timnah, Judah sees Tamar in prostitute garb, does not recognize who she is, thinks that she is a prostitute, and he propositions her. She is very businesslike in her response. Her response is, "How much are you going to pay me?" His offer is one kid from my flock. And she comes back in a very businesslike fashion. "What will you give me that I can know that I'm going to collect on what is owed me?" And he offers his seal and his staff. And the seal is, they're called cylinder seals. If you've looked at art history books of the ancient world, you've probably seen pictures of them. I've seen pictures, but I can't remember what scale those pictures are. My recollection is that the seal, the cylinder itself, is about this big, like about 2 inches long, and it's about 3/4 of an inch in diameter, and it has carved into it some kind of usually it's some kind of picture, a depiction of something, a graphic. And these are very important because it's a person's way of establishing their identity. It's a way of placing their signature on something. In the ancient world, documents were typically made on clay tablets. The tablets would be about the size of a hand. And the writing would be done, at least in Mesopotamia, the writing would have been done with a stylus. A stylus is it's a stick, the end of which is shaped like an arrow. And writing would be done by stamping this arrow in and twisting the stick at different angles to have the stamp of the arrow pointing in different directions. And you stamp, and that's the way you create the letters, is stamping that in different ways. That's the way you write a document. Then to sign the document, you take your cylinder seal and you press it down and you roll it across the clay. And it leaves an impression of that picture. And that picture is unique to you. No one else would have it. So you can always check to see if it's signed by you, because you take your cylinder seal. Does it match that thing? If it matches it, then you signed it. So a cylinder seal is that piece of identity, identifying token that you wear with a string around your neck, and that's the cord. So a cylinder seal and a staff, and the staff would have been distinctive. Everybody would have recognized Judah's staff, because everyone has a different carving at the top or some kind of embellishment that people would have recognized. So what she's asking is for all of his major pieces of identification. She's asking him for his license, driver's license, and his credit card, essentially. And he goes for it. He says, fine. So she collects those, they have sex, and she becomes pregnant. Now that is fortuitous timing, because she happened to be fertile at this particular time, and that makes this scheme work. Then she returns to her normal garb. She disposes of the prostitute garb. She puts on her widow's garb and returns to her former position. Verses 20 through 26. When Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who is by the road at Aneim? And they said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this kid, but you did not find her. See, I'll read on. Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. And Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. So Judah's trying to repay. He wants his driver's license and credit card back. So he sends his friend. He doesn't go himself. He sends his friend. Judah's a little indirect. We've seen that before, and we'll see that again. He's a little indirect. He sends his friend. His friend goes carrying this goat, but he can't find the prostitute anywhere. And he asks around, well, where'd the prostitute go? And everybody says, there was no prostitute here. There was never a prostitute here. So he goes back to Judah. What do I do now? And Judah's response is, we'll let her keep the driver's license and the credit card. I'd rather let her keep them than go around the whole village saying, I got conned out of my most precious possessions by a prostitute. Apparently, that's his thinking. He doesn't want to be a laughingstock. Okay. 3 months later, then, Tamar is found to be pregnant. She must be just barely showing. Must be just barely apparent. And Judah is informed that this is the case. Judah is properly outraged that this daughter-in-law of his has had sex, has violated the law and custom, and he says, bring her out and let her be burned. He appears to be calling for the maximum penalty here. And it just reeks of self-righteousness. And I suspect there's a certain amount of relief on his part. She has been a bit of a problem for him. What does he do with her? I don't think he thinks about it a lot, but it probably occurs to him occasionally that I still have a responsibility to her and would like to have that off of his conscience. And putting her to death would be a nice solution to that. She's arrested then, she's taken, but as she's taken, she says, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she wants that message to be sent to her father-in-law. Now, we don't know what Judah is thinking when he receives this message, but you would suspect that it at least occurs to him that those might be his. In any case, they are brought to him and presented to him, and immediately he recognizes them. They are his indeed. So he must now understand what has happened. She was the prostitute with whom he had slept. And that child, she is with child now by him. His response is, she is more righteous than I. And his explanation, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her. Inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah. What he recognizes is there is some nobility in Tamar. She has tried to do what is right. He had frustrated her from doing what was right. So she has come up with a way to approximate doing what was right as best as she could. Judah, on the other hand, has been irresponsible. He has not fulfilled the obligations that have fallen to him. He's tried to avoid them at every turn. And he recognizes that. And I think that there's a hint of contrition here, at least a realization that he has been in the wrong and that Tamar has been the more righteous. Now, the last four verses. And it came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. And afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So we have a curious little end to this incident. It's a description of the birth, and you can imagine the birth. A hand comes out. As I understand it, that's not the normal presentation. a hand comes out. They apparently know there are twins. And it is important to keep track of which one is born first. A hand comes out, and the midwife dutifully says, oh, this is the one that's coming out first, so that we don't get them mixed up in whatever follows. Let's tie a string around that hand. So she ties a string around the hand, but oops, the hand. Who's first? Who will inherit? Is consistently an issue throughout Genesis. And it's always the one that you don't expect. It's the one that's not customarily the one that inherits. In this instance, Perez is the one who is the firstborn, the one who did not have the string around his hand. He is the one who inherits, and Perez is the one who is the ancestor of David, King David later, and Jesus. So Jesus comes from this line, born to Tamar. Okay, I'm very briefly, the chronology. How do we crunch this chronology in? Can it work? I will not go into great detail. If you want to look into it in more detail, I urge you to look at Umberto Casuto's article on this. But very briefly, there is apparently 22 years from the time when Joseph is sold into slavery until the whole family goes down to Egypt. That's not a very long period of time for the events that are described in 38 to be crammed into. However, it does appear that they can fit. It appears as though Judah leaves his family very soon after Joseph was sold into slavery. Judah is about, he's in his early 20s, between 20 and 23 when this happens. He must have gotten married immediately upon leaving his family and going away. Then his wife must have given birth to the three boys, bang, 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 in very close succession. Er, when he was, and apparently 18 is legal age in Canaanite culture. So Er must have gotten married right when he was 18. Then when he died, his brother Anan would have been about 18, and about a year later, and then he dies, probably immediately. Shelah then is about 17, probably. And that's why Judah says we have to wait until he grows up, because he is not of legal age. But then he grows up. He turns 18, Judah does not have him perform his duty with respect to Tamar, and so that's when she goes into action. So she must have then conceived fairly soon after that, and then the children are born 9 months later. So it can conceivably fit into a 22-year period, but things had to happen pretty fast. So all of this is really crunched down. But it does appear that it would be possible. The most interesting question here is this chapter of any homiletical value? Is this of any value to us? Is there something that we can learn about how we ought to live our lives from the material in this chapter? If it all depends on what you conceive the Bible to be. I've mentioned this before, but I will mention it again. If you think of the Bible as a rule book that tells us how we ought to act in various circumstances, if you think of the Bible as the kind of material that is designed to help us to do right action, I would say that this is not of homiletical value. I would agree with Leupold. This is basically without homiletical value. She acts as a prostitute, and probably more sinister, she is deceptive. But I think that that would be a misunderstanding of what the Bible is about. The Bible is not like an IRS handbook that tells you what to do under every circumstance. The Bible is giving us a perspective on reality, on life. It's more how to cope with life rather than what you do in every circumstance. And in that sense, I think that this is a very helpful chapter. Because my experience is that as I go through life, I'm faced with difficult decisions where I have several options, but none of them good. So I'm constantly faced with the dilemma of choosing between bad options. None of them seem to be in line, exactly in line with what I understand God's principles to be. Even though, and we know that those are all, it's complex working that out. That's the problem. It's so complex that it looks like there are no neat solutions. And I'm frequently faced with a situation where I've got this array of bad options, and I pick the least bad. And it's still unpleasant because it's not a nice, clean solution to the problem. But what do you do? That's essentially the situation that Tamar is in. I have no good options. As she looks out, and her understanding of what is right, she looks out at her options and says, there are no good options. And so she selects what she understands to be the least bad of the options that are out there. And what's admirable about that is at least she wants to do what's right. And I'm convinced that the Bible's role is to help us to understand that that's the nature of life. It's constantly a struggle. We're always somewhat in the dark, choosing between bad options. And as we sort that out, as we struggle to figure out what should I do here, what would be obedient to God, it's always murky. And there are all kinds of ways for us to influence the process and steer it in a direction that we would prefer over that which God would want us to choose. And so we're constantly faced with the question, do I want what I want, or do I want what God wants? A lot of soul searching results from these constant struggles that we have. There's a sense in which we choose once and for all whether we want God to be our master or not. But there's another sense in which we choose several times a day. It's like, I liken it to dieting. You make a decision to lose weight, but daily you have to ratify that decision with every action that you take. And that's the nature of life for us, is daily ratifying our decision that we want to be obedient to God. And we're constantly faced with these murky situations. God made it that way because it's that struggle that is clarifying, and it forces us again and again to choose, do I want what God wants or do I want what I want? Consequently, I see Tamar's story as very encouraging. She is one of those people who's trying to do what's right with the best wisdom that she has, and she's just kind of muddling along. But God blesses her, and her plan is fulfilled. It works out. Not only that, but a child born to her becomes the line from which the Messiah is descended. By contrast, then, we see Judah, who is not intent on doing what God wants him to do. Judah has been enculturated. He has been seduced by the surrounding culture, has conformed himself to that culture. And there is sexual immorality that's involved, that he gives in to sexual immorality. But I don't think that is the sin that's being pinpointed here. The sin that's being pinpointed is his irresponsibility. And that we need to keep in mind when we look at the next chapter, because in the next chapter we see Joseph and his sense of responsibility doing what's right. Furthermore, Judah, he's given into the culture. He's given up the values with which he was raised. However, he wants to be seen as upright, and he is therefore a hypocrite. So I want us to think about this comparison between Judah and Joseph as we proceed, because Judah will show up later in the account. And so we'll want to carry that thread on through. Okay, I had promised to leave extra time for questions this week, but I didn't. So I guess maybe next time I'll leave half the time for questions. I will leave a lot of time next time, but I do want to have mercy on those taking care of children. Thanks.